the legislative session reaches halftime. The state cracks down on vaccine sites, plus the NCAA hosting fans, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 26th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, House Republicans approved a new two-year, $36 billion budget that they say boosts education and helps businesses recover from the pandemic. Democrats, however, say the GOP budget fails to adequately lift people up. Republican Representative Tim Brown is his caucus's budget architect. He touts $378 million new dollars for K-12 tuition support and grants for small business recovery, student learning loss, law enforcement, and regional economic development.
Indiana is the best state in the Midwest for jobs and people working, and that shows in the strength of how we budget in state government.
But Democratic Representative Ed Delaney says the budget fails to address many of the state's critical issues.
Are we continue to be overweight with high blood pressure, with low college graduation rates? Is that what we're going to do? Can we continue to pay our teachers $10,000 less than they should be making? This budget is absolutely devoid of any vision.
Republicans rejected every Democratic amendment to the budget, including small increases for women and minority-owned businesses and food banks, increased spending on public health, and more money for pre-K education. Are House Republicans' priorities in the right place? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, House Republicans couldn't find even one Democratic amendment to incorporate, really?
So Ann has the week off, and you just couldn't go 1 week without a Delaney taking shots at Republicans in Indiana Week in Review.
Lack of vision is literally something that Ann Delaney has said on this show. I felt it appropriate.
It's almost like they talk about it. Look, it's a wonderment this budget is where it is. One thing I'm getting really tired of talking about, and everyone's getting tired of hearing, is balanced budgets in Indiana, because we've been talking about them for so long. But you don't realize until you're in the situation we've been in for the last year just how important that is, that we're able to cash flow our way through dramatic drops in tax revenue, almost $1 billion in lost revenue, and we're able to come back in the subsequent session and increase K-12 education, increase contributions to higher education by 2%, provide grants to small businesses, and do all of that while you stay within the boundaries of a responsibly balanced budget. And so and if you look in the context of the rest of the country, if you add up all of the projected deficits in the other 49 states right now, it's sitting at $500 billion. So the fact that we were able to the House Republicans were able to put this budget together and build off of what Governor Holcomb sent them initially is a win.
Elise, I mean, this is a budget that I don't think a lot of people thought was going to be possible the last several months. Is it doing the job it needs to do, considering where House Republicans are spending the state's still relatively limited dollars?
Well, going back to the original question about accepting even one of the Democratic amendments to this budget, the things that were proposed were not astronomically high in cost, but they were very high in impact in making sure that everyday Hoosiers are being taken care of. You know, Dr. Brown talked about working people and how this budget affects them, but I'm not sure that this budget is good for working Hoosier workers. I also was really troubled that we weren't able to accept Representative Tanya Pfaff, a Democrat from Terre Haute, her amendment to restore career technical ed funding that is stripped from this budget for high schoolers who are looking to go into culinary, cosmetology, something that helps this show, radio and TV production. Those are some those are classes that sometimes get these students to school to learn and help them earn a good wage immediately after high school. We've stripped that funding. There was a Democratic amendment to add that back in, and I was very sorry to see that that failed.
Nikki Kelly, to Elise's point, some of the amendments that Republicans rejected were $500,000 for women and minority-owned businesses, $1.2 million out of a $36 billion budget for food banks. And the answers to why Republicans were rejecting them were, I mean, in a couple of occasions, Dr. Brown said, well, it doesn't fit with our priorities, or I don't know what the number should be, so let's reject this amendment. Are those answers good enough?
Yeah, I think there should have been a little bit more debate or explanation sometimes. I mean, basically, it came down to that's not in our plan. And if it's not in our plan, we're not accepting anything. And I do kind of wish, like you said, like they could look at one or two and say, you know, okay, can we afford $1 million to help our food banks in the worst, you know, time that they've had, not, you know, 100 years? Probably. And you know what? That's not going to impact the $2.3 billion budget. So they didn't do that. Now, I will give House Republicans credit. There is a lot in there to help people. There are grants for struggling businesses. There's learning recovery grants for students who are impacted. There are grants for health programs. So there are definitely some good things in there, which the governor's budget did not have. The governor just threw a big amount of money at paying down debt. It didn't do much for people at all.
John, at the end of the day, trying to parse a $36 billion budget is complicated for us and certainly complicated for people who don't follow this as closely as we do. But are Hoosiers going to be happy if anything like what the House Republicans have proposed becomes law?
I'm not sure it affects their happiness. Let's put it that way. There are some individuals certainly who will benefit from the grants that Nikki mentioned, and those people will come away happier. The companies that benefit, the health organizations that benefit will come away happier. But for the most part, I don't think Hoosiers in a year will look back and say, you know, wow, let's pop a cork on the first anniversary of the House passage of the budget, the great budget of this biennium. I just don't think it's going to have a big impact either way. In fact, you take out the grants, and I know that's significant, but if you take out the grants, it's really surprising to me how little impact COVID, this global pandemic, really had on the budget. Yes, it diminished revenue, of course, and yes, it has some extra programs at the margins, but really, I mean, you look at this from a distance or look at this in 10 years and say, is it a lot different from other budgets? I think most people would conclude not so much.
Well, speaking of the budget, controversial legislation that would create Indiana's first educational savings account program and expand the eligibility of state-funded private school vouchers is headed to the Senate for the session's second half. The proposal enjoyed strong support in the Republican-led House from numerous lawmakers, including Indianapolis Representative and bill author Bob Boehning.
House Bill 1005 expands the number of families who can now send their children to the school that best meets the needs of their children.
But Democrats, including Gary's Vernon Smith, pleaded for members to vote down the legislation. One of Smith's reasons is the bill would allow families with double the state's median income to become eligible for private school vouchers.
The entree was for poverty. You had to be at a certain income. And then the next thing we know with this bill, we're now expanding it to create opportunities for people who already had their children in private schools.
The increase for the voucher program would take up about a third of the overall K-12 education funding increase proposed by the House GOP budget. Elise Schrock, Republicans argue the pandemic exposed a need for greater school choice. Are they right?
I mean, I think the pandemic exposed the need for a lot of things in our schools, but I'm seriously wondering if House Republicans are actually listening to our legislator or to our educators and our parents, because frankly, I don't think expansion of an already robust voucher program was near the top of that list. Kids are more food insecure than ever. Kids are more housing insecure than ever. Our teachers are overwhelmed and dealing with an unprecedented time in history. 90% of our Hoosier children go to public schools. And in this funding formula, the money for the vouchers comes right off the top of that pot of money. I think this lacks empathy, and I think it does not align actually with Governor Holcomb's compensation commission plan.
Mike O'Brien, with 38% of the $378 million K-12 tuition support increase going to private school vouchers, which would mean that public schools are getting less than an inflationary increase in increased funding, is that defensible?
Well, I think if you look at the complete picture, it is. If you looked at the grants for learning loss to those schools, if you look at the $900 million in CARE Act dollars that have come to K-12 education, I think if you look at the larger pot of money, but you know, I think historically what we've seen in the legislature on choice matters has been that the House has always been much more aggressive. That Chairman Boehner has always shot pretty high on expanding funding, and that's always been dialed back in the Senate and moderated. So we'll see where this all winds up at the end. I do think that he's right, and that the pandemic did expose the need for alternative access to education for kids and potentially remote access. And so, you know, I think that's what, in part, what they're responding to, but it's not a slam dunk with Republicans either, because if you look at the floor vote, it passed 61-38, which is bipartisan opposition and quite a lot of it. And so as it heads to the Senate, that has been less aggressive about expanding choice, I think you'll see these numbers level out a little bit.
John Schwanes, Indiana has certainly had support for school choice for a decade now, or at least the Indiana legislature has. But is it harder to sell folks on giving school vouchers to people who are making nearly $150,000 a year?
I do think that catches people's attention. I mean, we pay close attention to the debates going on in Congress over the next round of stimulus and who will be getting the next checks. You know, will it be a family of four at $100,000 or $150,000? This, in the scheme of things, is a pretty generous threshold, it seems to me. And it gets back to, it's Exhibit A, I guess you could say, of the point I was making a few moments ago about this budget not being necessarily a COVID budget, because one could argue that in the wake of this pandemic, and the brutal hit that schools across the state had to endure, that all $378 million would probably go into shoring up the public schools. And the fact that there's a willingness to take a third of that and give it to families who arguably are not the ones who were reeling from this pandemic suggests, again, that I'll go back to what I said, this is not the pandemic budget.
Nikki Kelly, is this, Elise alluded to this, but is the debate over this heightened because Republicans in the General Assembly so far this session have not done literally one single thing from the governor's Teacher Compensation Commission recommendations?
Oh, absolutely. I think when you put out these 40-some recommendations for everyone, not just state lawmakers, but local units too, and they don't take even one of them, I mean, that's rough. And when you think about $378 million, you take out what we're giving to the private schools. I mean, how do you say to schools, that's even below inflation, here, use this to make up the $600 million gap in teacher pay that the pay commission actually, discovered and came up with. I mean, it would be one thing if they had one or two things over here to help teachers with pay, but they have zero on that side, and they don't seem to be budging on that.
All right. Well, Indiana officials announced this week they're cracking down on clinics that are vaccinating Hoosiers for COVID-19 who are not eligible under the state's guidelines. Teachers recently complained on social media that they'd been taken off vaccine wait lists around Indiana after state officials ordered vaccination sites to do so. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says the state regularly communicates with vaccine providers. She says it also clarifies the guidelines and cautions sites from violating them before taking punitive action.
There have been a rare instance, I would say, where individuals have really gone way outside the guidelines, and that is a situation where we ask that they would, we basically said they would no longer receive first doses from us, but they would receive the second doses to finish up anybody they had vaccinated.
Box says few, if any, people had to reschedule their appointments elsewhere when clinics were cut off by the state.
because what we wanted them to do was to finish out the appointments that they already had scheduled so that Hoosiers would not be disappointed.
Box says the state will work with those vaccination sites to get them up and running again in the future. John Tronis, we've talked throughout the pandemic on this show, for instance, about all the ways the state wasn't enforcing its COVID orders. They weren't really enforcing the gathering restrictions or limits on businesses. They certainly weren't enforcing the mask mandate. This, they have clearly decided to enforce. Does it feel like an overreaction?
It does seem a bit harsh when the push here and across the country has been to get as many doses into as many arms as possible. Now, granted, we have a system that gets the most vulnerable segments of the population at the front of the line, and that's a worthwhile pursuit. But eliminating the ability of clinics to distribute vaccinations seems to me to be a little bit harsh. And it seems that there might have been a better way to do it. And I should point out, if these clinics were, you know, not refrigerating, keeping the vaccinations refrigerated properly, or were somehow endangering members of the public, well, then I think it's obviously a different call. Then you say you're done.
Yeah,
you're never going to see another dose come through the door. But that's not the case here.
Yeah,
there's no indication that these clinics were doing anything that harmed the public, simply maybe didn't adhere to the letter of the law about who was eligible. And so maybe a warning or two or three would have been a little bit more appropriate.
Well, according to the state, they got warnings and apparently ignored them. But Nikki, we can't separate the fact that this, like we just talked about at the end of the last topic, teachers are heavily involved in this whole situation, are they not?
They are, but I also did want to point out one thing you didn't mention in your package, which is Dr. Box said that a few of these clinics actually had specific clinics for ineligible people. We're not talking wait list issues where you have two doses at the end of the day and you don't want to waste them. Some of them went even further than that. And in that case, I don't think that's an overreaction. But obviously the teacher issue continues to be a huge point of contention as the state focuses on hospitalization and deaths, and teachers are focusing more on the likelihood of transmission.
To that point, we haven't talked about it a lot on this show. So, Mike O'Brien, every state around us, a lot of states in the country, are vaccinating teachers. Should Indiana be doing that?
Yeah, I think if we had to do it over again, we should have included them in the essential workers, as we're concerned about, you know, the spread in schools. To your earlier point about selective enforcement, the state can enforce this. They control the supply. They control who actually does this. They don't control Joe Blow, who walks in a Walmart without a mask on. You know, you can put all the penalties you want on him, and he's not going to do it. So this is a very different situation. I think we're handling this, in hindsight, how we should have handled lockdowns, which is we put the strictest recommendations for quarantine on the people who are the highest risk. And that's what they've done here. And they've tried to take the people that are most at risk of contracting this disease and dying from it and vaccinate them first and make that the priority on a limited inventory of vaccines.
Elise, the state has been very clear throughout this entire vaccination process that this is their strategy, and the numbers seem to be bearing out that it's working. Certainly hospitalizations have fallen precipitously over the last month or two. Does that sort of make it better that this is the route that they've chosen?
Well, I don't think any of us want to see this fail, and I think we're all happy to see that if infection rates are dropping and it is working. I think the issue in this particular case is that teachers feel undervalued. They're largely unhappy with the way they're treated at the state level, and it was just kind of a bit of a powder keg waiting to go off. In this particular case, I think this stems from teachers being incredibly overwhelmed, having stories upon stories of what they're dealing with on a daily basis, trying to make remote and in-person and hybrid work. When you add something like not including them in essential workers, not getting vaccinated, it's going to exasperate things.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the state cut off new COVID-19 vaccine doses to clinics that flagrantly violate Indiana's eligibility guidelines? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you if you thought Governor Holcomb's emergency powers that he's used throughout the pandemic were too broad. Just 25% of you say yes, apparently all in the Republican caucuses at the State House, while 75% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the NCAA's decision to allow fans to attend March Madness could mean thousands more people in central Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports one health expert says some fans could be okay, but officials will need to vigorously track the spread of COVID-19 before, during, and after the games.
A limited number of fans will be allowed to attend games with a capacity limit of 25% at each venue. Lucas Oil Stadium could have up to 17,500 people, including fans, teams, and family members of participants. Indiana University epidemiologist Thomas Duszynski says he understands why there is a desire to have fans, but says there needs to be a safety net in place.
One, we need to make sure we have robust contact tracing in place, right? Two, we need cooperation from every other state and territory where people might be coming from, including teams.
Duszynski says if cases in Indiana increase before the tournament, officials need to be ready to adapt their plans.
Nikki Kelly, Governor Holcomb was asked about having fans at NCAA tournament games. What did he have to say about it this week?
Well, I mean, he said he does have concerns about the spread of virus and variants coming from other places, but he also said that those are the same concerns he has about in-person commencement and a volleyball game. Now, I would point out that for those things, we're not talking about, you know, teams and people coming from dozens of states. We're talking mostly about Hoosiers gathering, so it's a little bit different, but he's clearly trying to find a balance between, you know, an economic shot in the arm and trying to get the state back and, you know, moving in the right direction and, you know, obviously shutting it down altogether.
Elise Schrock, I want to ask you this question because obviously you're a little plugged into this community, which is the businesses, and I think about the restaurants and the hotels in downtown Indianapolis, who are obviously very excited about the business that's coming their way. Is there concern, too, though, that with all of these people, the risk is going significantly up?
Sure. Well, this is going to be a good, as it's been said, shot in the arm of business for industry that has been reeling in the wake of the pandemic. But I would also say that this industry was regulated by health and safety and sanitation pre-pandemic. And then the industry doubled down with the Hoosier Hospitality Promise, which is guidelines that, you know, the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association wrote in concert with the CDC, American Hotel and Lodging, National Restaurant Association, to go above and beyond and clearly communicate not just what we are doing to keep guests safe, but how guests can keep hospitality workers in the community safe. So I think that through clear communication, hopefully that will help. But, you know, there is no such thing as no risk right now.
Well, we're all praying it works out about as best as it can. We have reached the halfway point in the calendar for the 2021 legislative session. So it's time to ask about winners and losers from the session's first half. Mike O'Brien, I'm going to start with you. Who's your big winner of the first half of session?
One of the most overlooked bills this session is House Bill 1006, which was the police reform legislation carried by Representative Greg Stirwald. Did an incredible job in what in an issue in a state as red as ours. It's amazing that went through with broad bipartisan support. I've never seen that many co-authors from both parties on a bill. Came out of the House 96-0. Could have been hugely controversial or combative, and it wasn't. And that's just how Representative Stirwald has handled big, tough issues in the past, and he did it again. So that's my pick.
Well, you stole my answer. I think I said on Indiana Lawmakers this week that I think that could be the major achievement, not just of this half session, but maybe the entire session and maybe several sessions for the Indiana General Assembly and Greg Stirwald. Elise Schrock, winner from the first half.
I would say the same bill, but I would like to center the work of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus in what they have done to push this effort forward. Yes, it was great to have a Republican author and a Republican supermajority get this bill, you know, taken across the finish line. And I'm not diminishing the work that Representative Stirwald did, but I do need to uplift the work that the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus did on this bill in partnership and clearly communicated some of the demands that they would like to see implemented in state law.
Yeah, Representative Robin Shackelford, chair of the Black Caucus, a key co-author on that bill. I'm going to quickly go around the horn since we've reached the halfway point. Let's do grades for the General Assembly at the mid-session report card. I'll start with you, Elise Schrock. What grade would you give the General Assembly?
I'm going to give them a D, and that stands for diversity and inclusion training. They need to take it a little bit more seriously. They need to do it intentionally, and I would like to see a change in that in the second half of session.
Mike O'Brien, a grade?
I'll give him an A-. I was rooting for improvement, but just in how coming into the session, having no idea how it was going to go, how it was going to be conducted, whether it was going to last more than a week when they were all in the building together. It's a great achievement that we're at the halfway point.
I think that was a surprise for a lot of us, including the Republican legislative leaders, so it's very good to see. That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.